Listen, learn, and enjoy.
It's The Lisa Show.
With Lisa Valentine Clark and Richie T. The Lisa Show is happening now.
Are you looking for a way to diffuse a hard situation, decrease stress, and just connect with your kids? We do. And that's coming up in about 20 minutes.
Coming up in your morning buzz, crushing lava in a hydraulic press is fun.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's coming up in 15 minutes.
Now, here on The Lisa Show, we know that sometimes it's hard to sort of start your day and a new week. So we like to help you out by telling you something good.
Tell me something good.
Today's Tell Me Something Good is about a really kind, maybe even too generous, innkeeper. So if you'll remember, go back in time this past winter when Tennessee had some really low temperatures and it shut down power for a while. Well, Sean Patel is the owner of a local quality inn in that area, and he really wanted to help. He's got a really big heart. So he thought, okay, if people are going without power, then I'm going to give them what I have here at this quality inn. Food, warmth, they can come and stay until the power comes on. And in fact, some of his friends were asking him to dial it back a little bit. They were like, okay, you know, you could give maybe some discounted rooms, maybe some free rooms, but all of them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And very, very generous. He's an immigrant from India. He came to America in 2004, and he was really drawn to the South because everyone was so nice. Mm-hmm. And so he wants to be part of that and part of that community. He actually said, you know, sometimes it's just not always about the money. Sometimes you just need to be talk. And I wanted to be that kind of person. Well, not only was he that kind of person, but he continued to be. Now, remember back in time again when Texas had all of those really freezing temperatures.
And the snow.
Yeah, and power went out. Well, he happened to have an inn there as well, a hotel. So he opened it up, and he said on social media, if you can get here, we're going to take care of you. So people came, and between Christmas and New Year's of 2020, all 60 rooms in that hotel completely booked. Some people living in the lobby because they didn't have any power. Everyone pitched in, he said, though. It was really great because he saw it paid forward, you know, and you just kind of think he's in a position to help people. Great. But the way that it spread, the way he inspired other people is what is particularly inspiring to me. He said guests paid for each other's room. They were sharing food. And then when it kept going, like the staff opened up the breakfast bar. So everybody had something to eat. And the actual inn ended up losing power itself. Oh. And truckers who were staying there kept the fires going all night. Like, they're like, let's take a shift. And everybody really, you know, continued to keep it alive. They sort of caught the spirit of like, we're going to take care of everybody. Now, you know, months later, they still keep in touch on Facebook, checking in on each other's lives and keeping up, which is just so inspiring to me that when we're looking for ways to help other people, you never know how far it can go and how it can inspire others one by one. And he has really found a way to do that. And Patel said, we all have to look out for each other. Not only did he say it, but he meant it and he inspired it in others. And that's your Tell Me Something Good. Living life with a mental illness can often make you feel like you're stuck living life in neutral. Mental and physical fatigue went over our good intentions to clean the house or start a new hobby, or life seems to lose its vibrant colors and small tasks seem overwhelming. So when that's the case, it's easy to feel like all of our energy is caught up in fighting in our own head. So how can we put ourselves back in gear and find hope and growth while battling mental health problems? What are the things we can do to shift our perspective and find hope in spite of the struggles that seem to weigh us down? Well, to help us learn how to have a growth mindset while battling mental illness is founder of Life Sculpt Act, Trey Christensen. Welcome, Trey.
Thank you. It's an honor.
So what's the most important thing that we need to know to help us grow while battling a mental health illness and not just simply endure?
Two simple words, balance and acceptance. I think those are two of the fundamentals that we need to move forward and accept who we are struggling with mental illness and how we go forward.
Okay, I'm going to need to know more then. What more about balance?
Okay, so keeping away from the negative for a minute, we want to see ourselves like everybody else. There has been a stigma for a long time of not accepting mental illness as a disease or as a life-altering issue. And so we're balancing the struggle of, higher fatigue, less willingness to maybe associate with others if we have social anxiety, for example. But let's balance it with saying, what do we still enjoy doing? I still love being around my dogs. I love writing, even if I'm not good at it. So we're balancing what is hard in our life and holding us back to what we can do to pull us forward. And it's not a balance of fighting one thing against the other. It's a balance of saying, my morning was a little bit rough. I'm going to make the rest of my day amazing.
So when we're talking about that kind of balance, it seems like it is threaded with acceptance. I feel like that is such a broad word that could mean a lot of different things. How do you define really accepting it?
Well, if we ignore pain, it doesn't just go away. So if we're working hard, and from my own personal experience in the past, there was a time in my life where I went through a hard breakup, and something big like that in your life, while you also live with depression and anxiety, just causes everything to go absolutely volatile. And I would work so hard after that. I'm talking anywhere from 12 to 14, 16 hours a day. And then I would still take myself to the gym, but I also realized I'm sleeping like 5 hours a night. And I'm doing all of this to ignore the pain of not only what happened with the ending of a relationship, but I'm ignoring the pain of my day to day because now I'm also not seeing my friends. I'm also not talking to my family. And all because I'm trying to ignore the pain instead of accepting it. And this is a hard thing to do, and it took a while to learn. And ironically, I have found out from mental health professionals that we don't want to ignore it. That's worse than accepting it. That's worse than letting yourself feel the pain in your heart or the pain of a memory. And as you accept it, I don't know how familiar you are with different types of meditation, but it's a common thing in certain meditation is as you're meditating, you allow a negative feeling into your mind for a brief moment. You let yourself be open to it and feel that heartbreak or feel that loneliness. And then you release it. You're tying the negative to your current calm position, your current calm situation. And one thing that I learned too over time is if you're feeling in the midst of something super hard, and you can't accept it as it is in the present moment. You can't be mindful of maybe I just got laid off for work because of, say, the virus. Well, you can anchor yourself on something positive. And this is where the acceptance kind of does intertwine with the balance is I have two dogs and I love my dogs to death. And I've learned that I can anchor my struggle of these negative, dark feelings to something amazing. So I'll become mindful by petting my dog or taking my dog on a walk. And the same thing with, for example, I love coffee. It's the smell, it's the taste, it's the warmth. Same with hot chocolate, kind of, where, man, I've just had a stressful day and it's making my depression feel, I just feel terrible. Well, if I am in the moment with a cup of hot cocoa, I can then smell it, I can feel it, I can feel the warmth on my face as I take a sip. And you're accepting negativity by tying it to something positive in the moment.
We're visiting with Trey Christensen about growth and growth in the realm or in the universe of having a mental illness. And if you hear that, you think, oh man, is that even a possibility?
Right.
And Trey has shared with us how some of that is possible. And it's interesting, I relate with you talking about being really busy trying to not allow yourself the time to be able to deal with those things that may be hurt you in your past, or that you're just sort of afraid of the emotions that are around that. And for people that are listening to this, I think that that probably resonates with a good portion. But still, the idea of being able to be within those feelings can be risky at best and perhaps just treacherous for some at very worst. How do you suggest people, if they know, they're aware enough to know that that's an issue that they have, but are just really, really afraid of doing what it is that you say, how do you recommend that they get into something like that?
I think there's three things. Before you do any of these three, you have to take into account how severe is the thing that you want to address. A big thing for me was when I was 16 years old, when I started noticing depression was an actual issue in my life, my parents went through a very rough divorce, and that sort of triggered the first intention of suicide on my side. So that was something I knew years and years later, that if back to that moment, there's no way I'm comfortable being alone. And the stigma against therapists or psychiatrists is still here today, but nobody else has to know. And that was my approach to it. Nobody in my family or none of my friends have to know, but I feel that I want to approach somebody to talk about it. So that's the first way. If it's something very detrimental in your life that could have the associations of something as serious as suicide tied to it, please, please, please see somebody who is a professional that can help guide you through the exercise. The second thing is I've read several dozen books on the subject, and there's one I actually do recommend. It's called Feeling the Good by Dr. David D. Burns. And he's been studying the topic, I want to say, since the 60s. And it kind of guides you through how I can reflect without sort of making it hurt myself and ruin the rest of my day. And that's sort of what I said earlier, where you want to tie it to something positive. But before you do any of it, you need to get into that mindset beforehand. You're going to say, okay, and this is something I learned from a therapist myself, is you say, okay, I want to take 10 minutes this coming Tuesday where I'm going to sit down, I'll be alone, I'm going to set the setting to be comfortable, and I'm just going to think about what, let's take my parents' divorce, for example, what I felt in the moment, what I could have done different, what I thought was my fault in the moment truly wasn't my fault. And you're asking yourself questions, but you're applying what you know today. Everybody knows they're probably a better person today than when they were at that time. I would blame myself for the divorce, but I know now it's not my fault. Hmm. But I've also learned to forgive a lot more too. I don't hold any negative thoughts or feelings towards either of my parents based off that situation. And so it's the level of severity. Go see a healthcare professional if it's something that severe. If it's more mild, try taking into consideration reading or listening to an audiobook on the subject and learning their recommendations, or follow the anchor method, which is what I call it, where you anchor to positivity. Or my last thought on this topic is allow a family member or somebody you trust to sit there with you for a couple minutes just in silence.
Hmm. Why is that?
Because you're not alone. That's a big thing with depression, is you already feel alone all the time. For me, I grew up in a household of nine. There were nine of us, seven kids altogether. So I grew up totally alone. And then when I entered my first serious relationship, she was a single child, and so absolutely different in a lot of ways. And so the understanding of the background was a little bit off. So when you're able to sit down and they understand, okay, my spouse has depression or anxiety, they can sit down with you in silence and you're going to say, this is what I want to think about. I just want you to be here with me so I don't feel alone, because I am vulnerable when I do this. And you can talk out loud and you can say, I just want you to listen to me. I don't want you to say anything. I just need to get this out for a minute. And it is the perception of somebody's there with you to support you. Mm-hmm. You don't need their feedback. You don't need them to hold your hand. You just need the presence of somebody who loves you and supports you. And it gives you that space of increased comfort.
You know, it's really interesting that when we talk about depression and feeling alone and yet, you know, intellectually we know we're not, that this is something that we can really hold on to be able to have that growth mindset so we're not just feeling stuck. Unfortunately, we have run out of time. In the minute that's remaining, I am curious about those practices that you have found that create healthy emotional outlets that have worked for you.
Yeah, so a couple quick examples of healthy outlets. I'm a huge gym rat. I love going to the gym. I love working out. That's a really big one. I do go hiking with friends on time to time, and some of them struggle with their own anxieties. And just getting into the fresh air, seeing nature, hearing the mm-hmm. sounds of the birds chirp, those are huge. Getting the fresh oxygen has been proven to open up your mind, and it's a mental reset. But it's funny because there's a small practice you can do to start implementing things, and that's doing things you would do on a normal day-to-day basis, like commuting to work. Take a different route when you get dressed. Put the opposite arm in first. Put the opposite sock on first. Just small things like that, where you're changing the same habit, but still doing what you would normally do.
Huh. I like that.
A way to sort of mix things up is still be able to feel like you're moving forward.
Great actionable items from Trey Christensen, the founder of a business and app called Life Sculpt. It's dedicated to enhancing your personal well-being. You can learn more about it by going to lifesculptapp.com, and that's life, L-Y-F-E. Trey, thanks for being with us.
Of course, thank you.
When was the last time you just spontaneously started dancing? If you can't remember, it's been too long. We're going to tell you why you should consider doing it today, coming up in about 5 minutes.
You know what's fun? Crushing lava in a hydraulic press. It's also trending online. I'll tell you about it coming up in your morning buzz. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
How to get kids on board with chores in the summertime? Well, in about 20 minutes, stay tuned to hear all about how chores can be a rewarding part of your child's summer and how to implement it. But first, it's time for your morning buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online right now, things that folks are talking about. And this first one has some people very, very excited. Excited in the way of there's lots of chatter about this.
Got it.
The Jungle Cruise, you know, the ride at the Disneyland theme park.
Sure.
Well, a favorite by many.
Oh, yeah.
A new movie coming out with Dwayne The Rock Johnson and Emily Blunt here in just
a
couple weeks. They decided to change it in the last couple weeks. There are changes to the Jungle Cruise.
Really?
Yeah, they updated and removed some things that, in Disney's words, have, quote, negative depictions of Native people.
Oh.
A long time coming for a lot of people. Some people are critical of this, saying that Disney is now part of the, quote, woke culture. Disney just says, no, we're just being respectful to people. It, of course, just celebrated its 66th anniversary. Happy birthday, Disney. That is going on. Also today, a holiday that I would like to bring back.
Oh, okay.
Do you know what a flitch is?
No.
Well, William Harrison Ainsworth published the novel The Flitch of Bacon in 1854, which became popular in Britain and helped revive this custom. Regular events started being held in Great Dunmow, just a few miles from Little Dunmow. Follow me here. It's worth it. They're still held every 4 years on leap year. What is? Well, you take a flitch of bacon, which is a large slab of bacon.
Okay, already I'm intrigued.
To couples to wish them well in their marriage. The day is meant to remind us of the tradition, but that doesn't mean that you can't have a little fun with it. You can pick up a slab of bacon, give it to a married couple whom you believe is dedicated to each other, or just buy it for yourself.
What a great idea. I love this.
It's a great excuse to buy bacon and a whole lot of it.
A slab.
Get a slab or a flitch. It's National Flitch Day. It's great. You get it right in the back of, like,
yeah,
you know,
flitch.
Right on the tongue. Whole mouthful.
Here's your
flitch
of bacon. Have a happy marriage.
Yeah, you guys seem really happy. Dump it out on their counter. Why not? That's what you do. And then finally, when there's a video like this trending on YouTube, you watch it. It's not very long, less than a minute, and worth watching. It's called Crushing Lava in a Hydraulic Press is Fun. Now, the opening line of this video is a guy says, I really like to make lava, and then I was hooked. He heats up, magma to such a hot temperature using this, fancy thing, whatever. And then he sticks it in a hydraulic press.
Oh, and it doesn't melt it?
Press? You have to watch the video to
now
see
you've
for
got
yourself.
My attention.
But you'll find out that crushing lava in a hydraulic press is fun. That's your morning buzz.
Thanks, Richie T. Think about the last time that you were just really maybe stressed and overwhelmed, okay? And think about how you sort of felt in that moment about what you wanted to do. It was probably most likely something like, I just want to go lay down, right? Like sometimes we put ourselves in timeouts.
Yeah.
I do. I think if my if I have a bad attitude.
You need an attitude adjustment.
Yeah. I remove myself many times from the company of others, whether it's my family or friends, and just sort of hide in my cave. And when we do this, sometimes it's necessary, right, to take a rest. Sometimes it's the exact opposite of what we need, right? So I am trying to offer a different perspective for when you are feeling a little overwhelmed or stressed or maybe just done, right?
Mm-hmm. Checked out.
Instead of removing yourself from this situation, maybe you should consider something else.
Okay, I'm open to this idea.
Okay.
Maybe.
Okay, so this is what happened to me yesterday. Feeling like, oh, I got a busy week. What's going on? The house was loud, which I actually really like because all my kids were home, but they were doing weird things. Like they had gotten a new projector, and so they were turning off the lights and trying the projector, and there was
Like hand puppets?
Well, kind of. And then they were just trying to check out the machinery that they had. And then from the weekend, they had gone thrift shopping. So there was like kind of clothes everywhere. And they were just sort of comparing to each other. And then I had made dinner. This is another story, but I will try not to tangent. But I had made dinner and put it out on the table last night and called everyone to dinner because mom's rules are we just have Sunday dinner together, right? So it's the time. I'm like, where is everyone? I'm calling everyone. Two of my kids were asleep.
Mm-hmm.
Two of them were gone. And one of them was in the backyard jumping on the trampoline.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was like, where? It was sort of random. So I got my daughter, Margaret, who was jumping on the trampoline, in. And I was like, where is everyone? She's like, I don't know. Like, what? Why are you asking me? I don't know where everybody is.
I am not my family's keeper, mother.
So I said, look at this wonderful, beautiful spread of food that I have. Let's eat dinner. And she's like, I'm not hungry. I'm like, cool. She like grabbed a couple of cucumbers and was like, cool. So I'm looking at this,
This spread.
So that's what happened earlier. So I'm looking at the spread that's just kind of being picked at with the projector and kids just everywhere and clothes everywhere. And I think when you're trying to go to sleep, right? Mm-hmm. I think a lot of parents will really relate to the fact that you go around the house, you turn off lights, you like everything sort of reset so that it'll be ready to start the day and the week off right. And I walked in to the exact opposite, just total and utter chaos.
Yes.
The kids who had taken a late nap, as teenagers do, were super wired. There was food everywhere and everybody was talking. And I said, hey, guys, mom's getting ready to wrap it up and
go to bed. Got a big week this week, you guys. Not sure if you know this or not, but, I'm heading to bed. What are we doing here?
Exactly. In this moment of stress, my daughter, who is really funny, she's 18. She said, okay, yes, but before you go to sleep, you've got to listen to this song.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I don't want to listen to this song. How many parents are out there, when your kid is like, mom, You're going to love this. And you're right. Just inside, like rolling your eyes like, no, we don't have the same taste. Yeah. I probably won't love it. But you just put on a smile because you don't want to discourage, you know, them sharing
things with you. It's an opportunity to connect.
It's an opportunity to connect, right? So this is the turning point in my night where I had this thing in my mind where I thought, you know, the connection that I was looking for earlier when I made dinner mm-hmm. and spread it out and nobody was there is happening now. Mm-hmm. You know, a few hours later, you wanted it to happen earlier, but it didn't.
Right.
But it's happening now. Don't mess it up. Mm-hmm. Like, this is what you want, so don't complain about it.
Right.
You wanted all your kids around you. You wanted to laugh and talk. It's happening now, so just lean into it. So I did, and I said, all right, hit me. Let's put on the song. So she puts the song on the smart speaker. And you know what? It's like dance party music, which isn't really my love or whatever.
Your
but it was
jam,
my
if you
jam,
will.
If you will. But it was a good song, and we all just kind of looked at each other without saying anything, and at a full-on dance party.
Now, when you say a full-on...
It was great.
Now, when you say a full-on dance party, when I think of a Clark full-on dance party, it reminds me of like when you catch a fish and it lands in the boat, and the fish wants to get 100%. Back into the water, and it's just sort of flopping.
Yeah.
Like, there's a little bit of rhythm, like if you look really closely, but for the most part, it's just sort of flopping and undulating.
Yeah, that's exactly what we dance like. We're not known for our dancing. We're known for our enthusiasm and comedy and dancing. So it just happened. We all just kind of did it. And then when that song was over, it was just like organically, then the next kid would say, Alexa, play this, and mm-hmm. then put on a different song, and which was a great one. Mm-hmm. And it happened for about three or four songs that we all just gave into it and had our dance party. And I was thinking about that last night as I was going to bed. Finally, I did. I was able to. About how important those moments are. And I, like many parents, try to force those to happen a lot. And I don't think that that's really bad. I don't think it's bad to try to force it, honestly.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get down on myself for that because it's not going to happen every time.
Sure.
But when it does, it is a very connecting and bonding experience. And like I said, it's what I craved earlier, didn't give up,
mm-hmm.
and it just happened. So I was curious and did a little bit more research as to, like, what is it about a dance party that either sort of intimidates people, but once you have one, like, it's so great. And there's actually a lot of research on dance parties about how it connects you emotionally and socially. Like, this is why we get together and dance when we go to, you know, weddings and celebrations and when we're looking to connect with other people, because it does just that emotionally and socially. And it also can de-stress a situation. You know, I was very stressed out, like, oh, the house is a mess. I got to go to bed. It's going to be a busy week. And I was sort of worked up. But after the dance party, I wasn't stressed. I was like, oh, yeah, well, that's fine. This was great. Oh, I connected with my kids. This is awesome. And it does de-escalate a situation or de-stress. And then another thing that it does is it really increases, like, sort of your brain function, mm-hmm. you know, where you're able to see things a little bit more clearly. Whereas I think sometimes we have such a myopic vision of, like, I got to do this right now. And this is how I'm seeing the situation. The house is a mess and it should be clean. Bah, 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 bah. Mm-hmm. And instead taking a step back and seeing it as the whole and having a bigger perspective, it gave me all of those benefits. So just doing something so similar, you know, just putting on some music may be a great parenting tool that you've either underestimated or overlooked during moments of stress that maybe should become a little bit more part of your everyday routine.
If I may, though, on the other side of this.
Oh, no. You're not going to counterpoint this, are you?
I just want to throw this out there. Where this should not be applied is when your wife says, hey, I need to have a really serious conversation with you. And then you say, hey, smart speaker, play this song. And
good
then just
point.
Start dancing as she's trying to tell you something that's very serious.
Is this a cautionary tale?
I mean, I'm not saying that it happened to me, but I'm also not saying that it hasn't happened to me and that I don't have a go-to funk channel on my smart speaker that whenever my wife wants to talk to me about serious things, all I always say, hey, smart speaker, play the funk music. And then it's... Can't get through the conversation. And then I guess...
Don't do that.
I guess to your point, though, it takes what would have been a very serious and heavy conversation... Yeah. Delays it for a minute and then makes it a little lighter and a little less heavy. Do you think that this has applications in the workplace?
I don't know. That's actually a really good question, because when you think about the sort of level of understanding and inside joke and connection with your family, it doesn't always translate to the workplace. Now, if you were in a management position... If you were the boss and you wanted to do that, you could kind of Michael Scott your way through that reference to
From the office.
But if you were in the middle of a meeting and you weren't in a position of power and you tried to do that, it might get you in trouble.
I want you to look at this $100 bill. $100. We have a meeting today.
No.
If you dance party our meeting, this $100 bill is yours.
I don't think it would go over very well.
I don't. You don't know that it wouldn't go over very well for the purposes of being able to share that story later this week on the Lisa Show. Think about it.
No, I don't know. But I will do it 100% in my family more than ever. I will do it more often.
Yeah, to the serious point of what you were saying, though, I think so much of what parenting is and the times that you really connect are those times where, like, you're able to break down maybe a rule and you just, you know, you extend a little grace as far as that goes.
Mm-hmm.
Or we probably shouldn't do this, you know, breakfast for dinner or
whatever.
Ice cream for dinner, whatever the thing may be, when you take something that's out of the norm and they recognize that you're, you know, doing something maybe a little bit different. Kids love that stuff.
Yeah. And I do feel like because the business of parenting is so intense, and especially at this time of the year when you want to sort of have fun, but you've got to have some structure, and that's a lot of times very difficult to maintain during the summer, that parents need to be there for each other. We need each other to support. You shouldn't parent in a vacuum just by yourself and not share your joys and your hardships and, you know, everything in between with other parents. We have to, because the stakes are so high, we have to support each other and we have to share ideas about things that say, oh, you know, this actually worked, or this was a great moment. And not in sharing that, I'm not trying to say, oh, I'm such a great parent, or this happened, or whatever. I'm just saying, oh, I forgot about that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a great tool for parenting. Oh, I actually enjoyed that. That actually brought us closer together. That actually created something that I was looking for. And just having that, like, floating out and talking to other parents about ideas like that, because I want to collect ideas like that. And if somebody has something that works, you got to share it, because parenting is an overwhelming, underappreciated, just sort of important, I mean, vitally important, not only to society, but to our individual health and well-being, that we have to share ideas with each other. We have to support each other in doing that. So in saying, hey, maybe think about a dance party, not as another thing on your to-do list to check off or anything like that. But like, if you are stuck in a moment.
And you can't get out of it.
And you can't get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You might want to turn on a little bit of music to diffuse the situation and to sort of change the atmosphere in the room.
If there's something that you and your family is doing, maybe send those things along to us. It's thelisashow@byu.edu. You can put connection suggestions in the subject line, or even just an experience that you've done within the walls of your home. Can be particular to the summertime, or can it just be you know, something that you've experienced and done? We would love to hear from you. It's thelisashow@byu.edu.
And just a quick reminder that Lisa's Adventure Club is well underway. You can go to byuradio.org to enter for a chance to win an annual National Parks Pass. That's going on. We're going to be reminding about you of it all week long, so you won't miss anything.
Coming up, we're talking about chores. We've talked about chores with Carrie Ann Rhodes last week. Now, how to enforce and follow up those summertime chores with your kids.
Thanks for listening to The Lisa Show. We know that the last thing that your kid wants to do in the summertime is think about chores, but
I hate chores. No bones in my body.
It's so true. Or my favorite, I'll do it later. I just need to rest. It's the summer.
It's so hot. Or my favorite,
yeah.
I already did it.
Oh, yeah.
I did it last week. Sister didn't do hers.
Yep.
Deflect, deflect, deflect.
And here on the Lisa Show, we've talked about different ideas to try to motivate your kids or to, you know, implement a way to make it a little bit less of a fight and more of a, hey, everybody pitches in. Mm-hmm. When you live in this house,
yeah.
Mom's not the maid. Dad's not responsible for everything kind of way to talk to your kids about doing chores. But we rarely do like a follow-up. So that's what we want to talk about right now is maybe you have tried some things. You've pivoted. You've talked to your kids in a different way. You've made that new chart. You've sat the family down and you've tried to reason with them. And this is a way to sort of check in so that other parents we can discuss and say, well, what works for you? Is it time to change and pivot a little bit more, or is it time to double down? So here to help us answer these kinds of questions when we're talking about how to take care of your home and your stuff with your family. Do you see how I didn't say chores?
Mm-hmm.
Is friend of this show, Carrie Ann Rhodes. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Good morning. That couldn't have been a more perfect previous segment to segue into what we're going to talk about. If your kids have a favorite song, even if you find it completely obnoxious, for instance, It's Raining Tacos. Have you heard that song?
Of course.
I have not.
Terrible.
You don't know It's Raining Tacos?
No.
Oh, my goodness.
It's yep. Raining Tacos. If I say, okay, I'm going to play It's Raining Tacos, and in that time that the song plays, we're going to clean up this room. You're going to pick up your stuff, or we're going to, you know, giving kids a time limit is great. Making the time limit a song is even better. So combining that kind of idea of like family dance party with cleaning up, that was so terrific. That was like the best way to introduce this. So thank you very much this morning.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, I do feel like parents are all looking for ideas and ways to encourage each other in conversations. What are some of those sort of tips, like you've just mentioned, you know, having a time limit or playing a song that people who are looking for a different perspective or a different way to look at it could try out this week?
Okay, this one was hard for me, and it's something that I've kind of faced this summer. I've been kind of analyzing, you know, what's the most important thing here for me? We talked about last week the idea that I'm teaching my kids that this is their responsibility too, that when we live in a house together, it's a group effort. It's not, you know, one person's job, et cetera. But then I kind of looked around and thought, well, how am I making this doable for my kids? And two things that I noticed specifically, one of them was in the kitchen. And if I'm expecting my kids to do the dishes, are my dishes stored where kids can actually reach them?
Oh, okay. So for your system.
Right. Like for traditionally, we kind of keep, you know, plates and cups and things in cupboards that are above the counter, but can your kids even reach them?
No.
No, so they don't have to do dishes ever again.
That's right.
So
not helpful.
One thing I can do is I can kind of look at my storage solutions around the house and kind of say, okay, is this reasonable to expect a child, you know? And of course, as we've got different ages, if you've got teenagers who are, you know, kind of adults, height, then they're going to be fine. But my kids are a little bit younger. So if I'm expecting them to do these things, I need to make those chores accessible to them. And that goes for storage in their rooms too. So I am a folder. I like things to be folded. I like things a certain way. There are certain things I hang up, certain things I fold. And in my mind, to maintain my own sanity, I have a very kind of stringent rule of like, where things go and how they get folded and like color order and stuff so that I can find things. That's
oh,
the way
sure.
like my brain works.
Mm-hmm.
This summer I have had to, like, it was a conscious decision to let go of some of those things. And I know there's lots of parents out there that are like, Carrie, duh.
Yeah.
But you know, this is news to me. And so if there's any, you know, if there's any other parents out there who need to kind of let go. So what we did is is we just got bins. And so instead of me expecting my kids who are little to fold things the way that mom would fold them, I'm a total like Marie Kondo, fold t-shirts this way so that you can see them and they all line up. And I said, no, you don't have to fold. They just get thrown in this bin. And the bin goes in, you know, a little storage cubby. And so we decided that for things like underwear, t-shirts, socks, shorts, pajamas, you throw them in, because for me, it's more important that their room is picked up and that they've taken responsibility that way than that their clothes are folded the way that mom likes them to be folded, with like the PJ top and the PJ bottom folded together so you can grab them. I've let go of some of those things, but it's, you know what? It's made me happier.
Yeah. So I want to take a little step further. I know that we're talking about the kids and the chores and their responsibilities, but on that side, how are you faring with it? With I'm being serious, because I think that there are some parents that think this will drive me so crazy.
Yeah,
I can't handle this.
Let it go. Yeah. But what does that mean?
Yeah, I'm in this system. What this would be too much for me. How are you doing having let that go with your kids?
So what I do is that I do the laundry, because the kid, you know, my kids can't like reach the soap and the knobs and whatever. So I'm fine putting the laundry in, getting into the dryer, taking it out. And so what I do is I say, I will fold your clothes and separate them into, you know, the boxes that they go in the first time, right? And that way I feel like I've got a little bit of control of at least like keeping t-shirts, you know, kind of folded and neat before they get crumpled in the box. But then, you know what, once those t-shirts, the kids put them away, they put everything away where it goes. If it gets worn and it's clean, it goes back in the box. If it gets worn and it's dirty, they throw it in the dirty clothes. And so at least I feel like I've got control of things coming out of the wash, helping them get into the right place in a decent condition. But after that, I have to just let go. If they're picking up their rooms and they're deciding not to fold and just throw it in the box, I have to let that go and be okay. And it's been fine. And I'm okay. I just can't look
She's
inside
okay.
that box, or else I have a desire to start like holding and matching up those things. But, you know, I'm okay to let that go.
I want you to know, and I'm being very serious, that I'm proud of you, because I know that that's not the easiest thing.
Richie, thank you so much for
that. You're welcome.
Something else that my mom actually brought up that I had totally forgotten, she reminded me. She said, do you remember the china that our wedding china that we got? And I was like, oh, yeah, they have this beautiful blue and white. She said, in the 80s, when you guys were all at key ages, I put away my nice dishes and she literally went to Target and bought a whole set of melamine cups, plates, and silverware. And she said, these are going to be our dishes for the next 10 years. She kind of had to let go of the idea of using her china that she had chosen and whatever, because things got broken. Kids will break things. And in my house, it's my husband who breaks my glass cups. I don't know why I insist on having glass cups, but I do. And and so you kind of, that's another way to kind of let go. Do you find that your nice things are kind of getting ruined by kids?
Mm-hmm.
Store them away for another couple of years, buy some more indestructible things or whatever, and be happy using those until, you know, later on you can bring out, you know, the nice silverware that won't get thrown away. Or
you'll have white carpet when you're older,
yeah.
But not while you have kids in the house.
Nope.
We're visiting with
sofa someday.
With Carrie Ann Rhodes, friend of the show, talking about sort of this follow-up with chores. We often have the discussion about how we're going to get these things accomplished, but then we never follow up and check back in. I just need to ask a question so that I can be in the cool kids. What's melamine? I don't know what that is.
It's like a plastic.
Okay.
It's like a very durable, like hard plastic that you can put in the dishwasher, eat off of, and it's indestructible. And melamine, they make the cutest, you know, patterns and things like that. So it's kid safe and it's cute for your table. You don't feel like you have to sacrifice, you know, on cuteness just because you need something indestructible.
I mean, I knew that. I just wanted to make sure everybody knew. Yeah.
Asking for a friend.
Cool. Mm-hmm. It's melamine. Guys, is that melamine? What a cute pattern.
I wanted to follow up and ask you about that, towing that line between letting them do it on their own at sort of their own pace and following up and sort of encouraging as they are doing their chores. For kids of lots of different ages, what's your advice?
Well, we talked last week about setting those expectations and then setting boundaries. And sometimes it's a time limit. You have to say, you know what, by noon today, this needs to happen. But a great way to kind of, like we talked about at the beginning, to kind of set those different time limits and to kind of motivate quickly is just to put on that song, because it becomes kind of a, songs are very motivating.
Yeah.
You know what's going to end. Oh, let's get it done before the song ends. And my parents actually had they called it the black bag. My husband's family, they had the same system where they called it the gunny sack. That one's even scarier. If by this time limit, if things aren't cleaned up, the items that are left go into the black bag.
Oh, my word.
Or they go into the gunny sack.
And then what happens?
And then what happens to them?
And then you have to earn them back.
Oh, because I was going to say, like, if it's expensive stuff or new clothes, you might think, oh, I can't, like, just throw it away. But, store it. They have to earn it back.
Right, they have to earn it back. And that's also, I mean, that only has to happen once or twice before you, like, become terrified of the sound of a garbage bag being shaken open to realize the black bag's coming, you know, hurry and get all the rest of your stuff picked up. But my final thing on that is you need to rethink where things are stored to help kids put them away. Like, if kids are playing with crafts in a certain area of the house, which weirdly in my house, it happens on a coffee table or the dining table. I had to kind of relook at where are these things stored? Am I making them put things away across the house? Is that going to help motivate them to do that? Or can I be storing them somewhere closer to where they're actually used? And that kind of simple intuitive storage will help a parent, you know, stay sane and make it easier for the kids to actually pick up once they're done doing things.
So a little bit of wisdom from Mama Robin, my mom in this chore space. And you talked about the gunny sack, the black bag. Ours was a laundry basket. And what she would do is she would say, particular day, particular time, everything that's in the laundry basket or anything that's left out goes into the laundry basket. And she took it to the thrift store without question. So it was straight up like, hey,
wow.
And it took us one time of her doing it with being like, yeah, right, you would. She went through the house laundry basket, chucked it in the laundry basket, took it right away to the thrift store. And then the rest of the time, whenever the threat of the laundry basket was even given out there, it was, okay, all right, no, wait. Never had to worry about it again.
That was some serious follow through.
You know, as my kids have gotten older, different things motivate different kids. I've learned. And for older kids and for teenagers, reasoning works, I think, a little bit better, obviously, than when you're a little kid. But also, I don't think anyone, myself included, doesn't respond to a really good bribe or an incentive. So a lot of times where I'm like looking around the house and I think, okay, you know, every Saturday I've conditioned my kids over, you know, 20 years. Saturday, we just do chores. That's what we do. There's no getting out of it. You might as well accept your reality. And I usually give, you know, a couple of chores for each kid. But if it's a big thing like, oh, we've got company coming or we're going to have a party or for whatever reason, this house is particularly trashed and I need extra help and a little extra time from everybody to pitch in, I will often say, okay, I know it's going to be a lot, but if we all work really hard and do that, then we'll go to the gas station and I'll get you whatever you want, you know, or I'll buy you lunch at your favorite place, you know. So if it's a little above and beyond, and I think that actually motivates me too, you know, if I think, oh yeah, I'll go get a nice, you know, cold frosty beverage after I'm done or my favorite candy bar or whatever it is. You know, don't underestimate that. I think if you don't overuse it, that it does sort of help.
Oh, absolutely. And finding that kind of age appropriate bribe. Like I don't know anyone of any age who doesn't want, you know, the treat from the gas station. So that's a good kind of general one, but use those rewards and make them special sometimes. If it's a big thing,
but you can't do that every week or else it sort of loses its power.
No. You'll go broke. But I think the number one thing that parents struggle with when it comes to like any of this, teaching your kids anything or the discipline, is just the consistency. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes every time, when a kid doesn't follow through with kind of the chores or with the behavior, it punishes the parents, right?
Like, right.
We're the ones that kind of live with those consequences. And so part of just kind of maturing as a parent over the years, right? We don't expect this right away, is just to be patient, take deep breaths, have dance parties, but be consistent, right?
Yeah.
Just each week, this is what we do. Every Saturday, this is what we do. Until finally, I promise it's going to sink in. It sunk in for me. I was the worst as a kid. But you know what? I turned out to be an okay adult who does her best to clean the house. And so we kind of have to keep that perspective, too, of like, these are kids. They are going to be on their own. Like, what you've taught them will actually sink in someday.
Great advice. Friend of the show, Carrie Ann Rhodes. You can find and follow her on Instagram. It's Carrie_on_Carrie_the_Lisa_show. That's where you can find her and follow her for all the great tips that she shares here on The Lisa Show with us. We'll talk to you again next week.
Now, just quick reminder, Lisa's Adventure Club is well underway, and you need to go to BYURadio.org to enter for a chance to win, and we are going to help you do that.
An annual National Parks Pass is what we're giving away every week. A $500 Visa gift card is what we're giving away at the end of the summer. You cannot win if you do not enter. BYURadio.org is the website that you need to go to. And the special keyword of the week.
Because there's a new one every week. Listen in.
Are you paying attention? Are you ready to enter this in? Do you have it ready to enter in your phone? Maybe you're going to write it down. Jot it down on the chalkboard that you have in your house or the whiteboard, whatever you've got. The word of the week is camera.
Camera. Oh, you said it weird. Camera.
I knew you were going to try and say it with me, so I wanted to make it so we didn't say it the same way. Camera. It's, you know, like I take a picture with a camera, or is that a Polaroid camera? I haven't seen one of those in a long time. Camera, C-A-M-E-R-A. When you're prompted to enter that keyword, that will get you more entries. Camera is the word. Be sure that you enter to win so that you can win on Friday.
Have you ever felt a teeth gritting, fist clenching sensation when you thought something was really cute? Well, coming up next, we're going to learn about why we experience something called cute aggression.
Every single time I look in the mirror, I'm like, that is so cute. I am so tense right now. Why is that? So that's not what you mean. That's not what we're talking about.
Different. Mm-hmm.
Cuteness aggression. All right. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
You're listening to Richie T and Lisa Valentine Clark. It's The Lisa Show.
Could you weather another lockdown? Coming up in 20 minutes, we'll teach you how.
And one Olympian from the United States of America tested positive for coronavirus. I will tell you who that is coming up in your morning buzz. But here on The Lisa Show, we like to start your week off with something positive. We call it Tell Me Something Good. And this week's Tell Me Something Good, it's short, but I just love it so much. There's a group called Improv Everywhere, and they do different things. Like, they did the thing where they all froze in Times Square at the same time, and everyone sort of panicked, like, wait, what's going on? Am I in a different universe? They had a... out in New York in one of the parks, they put a little decal down on the pavement that said, stand here for a dance party. And, well, I mean, if I were in that park and I saw that particular thing, I would probably stand there for a dance
100%.
Party. Or at the very least, I would go, I wonder what would happen if I stand here for a dance party. Well, sure enough, they recruited 100 improvised dancers that would be sort of waiting in the park or in different parts. And then if they saw someone stand on their the little decal for a dance party, the music fired up and they come out and dance and they almost scare the people. There's video of this. There's also the story that surrounds it. But the big thing for people is it was just something that they could do, something that that they could be able to just have a good time. It's not, maybe not life-changing necessarily, but potentially could be life-changing to just not take life so serious. But you never know. Here's the application, personal application to all of us. You never know where you might stand where a dance party could happen. Now, obviously, not literally, but are there those opportunities where you could just have that fun in your life where maybe it wouldn't be otherwise, or can you create that fun for the individuals in your life that maybe you haven't before? This is their first time out of the pandemic doing something like this. It brings a lot of joy to people. So stand here for a dance party. That's your Tell Me Something Good.
Thanks, Richie T. Have you ever seen a baby with the cutest little face and you just wanted to squish its cheeks? Or a puppy with soft, fluffy ears that you just wanted to grab? Maybe you've experienced this, maybe you haven't, but this so-called cute aggression phenomenon is actually pretty common, which makes me feel better because every time I see a baby, I just want to grab the folds of its fat and eat it like a big ball of bread dough. I feel it in my bones. I'm glad I'm not the only one. Because even though you may feel like clenching your fists, which is literally what I just did, when you see something cute, you don't actually want to hurt it. But why does this happen? What is it about cute things that makes us feel aggressive? Here to answer our question today is Dr. Oriana Aragon, a social psychologist who studies why our emotional expressions don't always line up with how we feel. Welcome, Dr. Oriana. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, cute aggression. Is it just a feeling or is it a phenomenon?
Well, I think it's kind of both, right? So there are these really strong feelings when we look at cute things, and they can manifest in different ways. So you could just look at a baby and smile and say, oh, it's so cute. Mm-hmm. But you could also look at a baby and go, oh, my God, I want to eat it, right?
Right, which is what I tend to do, yes.
Yeah, so a lot of people do it. You know, the estimates that we have from our research mm-hmm. is somewhere between 50 and 60% of Americans do this, say, where you have this really strong urge to squeeze or to grit your teeth when you see something incredibly cute. In fact, one of our very first experiments, I wanted to see if people were squeezing, and I was a grad student at the time, and I was trying to find like an economical way to capture squeezing.
Okay.
And I thought we could have bubble wrap. We could have them look at cute pictures while holding bubble wrap and see how many bubbles they pop.
Oh, what a
when
great
they look
idea.
At cute. I know, it was funny, right? When they look at cute versus less cute pictures of little baby animals versus adult animals, essentially. And yeah, people squeezed more when they saw that cuteness. So it's not just sort of a saying or an expression. There's an actual behavioral like movement to it, that squeezing and the clenching of the teeth and the tightening of the jaw. There it's a physical expression of that actually really deep care and loving for the animal that's showing up a little bit differently on the outside of the body. And that's called a dimorphous expression, when the inside feelings don't exactly match what you see on the outside.
Okay, a dimorphous expression. Does it match the outside how you feel? And I appreciate you pointing out that aggression because it's deep care and loving. I'm not going to hurt the baby, but I deeply care. When do and under what circumstances do people experience this kind of cute aggression the most?
It seems that, I mean, it's an individual difference, which means some people do this. And others think that those people are crazy and don't do it. So some people do this and other people don't. And people who do this, anytime they find something cute and appealing, they have these urges. And the cuter it is, the more emotionally engaged they are with it, the more that cute aggression shows up. So it has to do with feeling intense care and wanting to be close to and play with that baby or cute thing. And being someone who tends to express this way.
What if, and I'm just saying, you know, like a purely hypothetical though, but what as we, if we feel this cute aggression, it becomes too much emotion. Like we feel it and it seems so intense that it's sort of, you know, discomforting. It feels very uncomfortable. What do we do with that?
You know, I think that's where a lot of this like, growling gritting, that where the expression is getting to be too much. And so then people start actually vocalizing and saying, grrr, you know, it starts to, I think you sort of release it that way through the expression. So, yeah, it's funny because these do come about when people are feeling really overwhelming feelings of care for something cute. And so it's funny, you're like, well, what happens when that overwhelming becomes overwhelming, right?
Yes.
And I think it does manage to resolve itself. We've found through our research that really one of the most critical things that we've found about these types of expressions, the dimorphous expressions, is that they send really strong signals to other people around you about how you're feeling. So when people do the aggressive expression when looking at something cute, let's say the caretaker of the infant that has a baby there will understand that you want to approach that infant and you want to play with it and you want to rile it up and rev it up and have fun. But there's another dimorphous expression that we make when we look at something cute. You could call it cute sadness. People do a really pronounced pout. Their eyes, their brow wrinkles, and they go, oh, and it's like a sad face. It's like this really exaggerated sad face. They go, oh, look at the baby. And when they have that dimorphous expression, it sends a really strong signal to the caretaker that this person wants to calm my baby. They want to soothe my baby. So it could be that one of the reasons why we do these expressions at all is for its signaling ability. Hmm. And those signals are sent above and beyond what a smile sends. So when you have a situation, we've done this experimentally where we've tested, we're like, okay, this person's smiling, this person's doing the cute aggression, this person's doing the cute sadness. When they're smiling and you're approaching a baby, the mother doesn't know which way you want to interact with the baby. They're not sure.
I had never considered that before, huh?
If you're just joining the conversation, we're talking about cute aggression and dimorphous expression. It almost sounds like, these sort of foreign words, but I feel like we've done a really great job with Dr. Oriana Aragon to be able to describe what they are, what they mean, what they don't mean, which I really appreciate, for those of us that may be uncomfortable in how much we feel. I get so curious because... Is this a newfound phenomenon, or are we just able to kind of put labels on it and be able to explore it more because of our awareness?
Well, the dimorphous expressions people had recognized in our psychological literature and also in sort of even writing, for hundreds of years, there's this idea of crying tears of joy. You can even find biblical references, right, of, tears, weeping of happiness. But the cute thing is very different. So that wasn't really identified and quantified until I looked into it. So what happened was I was watching Conan O'Brien in 2011 in the summer, and the actress Leslie Bibb was on, and she was talking about this cute puppy that was so adorable. She just wanted to kick it in the head, and she was doing the gritting of the teeth and the... Yeah, I know, it was funny. And Conan was, laughing at her and, God, you're acting really strange. But I was an emotion researcher, a grad student at Yale at the time, and I saw that. And I went, what is that? And so it really was the very next day I spoke to my father on the phone. He goes, well, how much different is that than, a grandparent pinching cheeks or these other ways that we sort of show this grittiness and this squeezing of hands? And that's when it just hit me. I was like, wow, we do this. And I started to document it. I looked in languages around the world for evidence of this sort of, cute aggression, and it was there. And I did the bubble wrap experiment that I described, and I surveyed people around the nation, do you do this? And they were saying, yes, I do. And so from there, it actually got documented and I've published the first paper on it in Psychological Science. And so it really didn't get quantified and understood at all until the 2014, 2015.
So knowing that you're sort of a pioneer in this cute aggression, are there naysayers? If I know anything about science, it's that you've got a theory and someone else says, no, come on, Oriana, it's clearly this.
It's funny because our science community sometimes, yes, there are some people, there's a group of people that really believe in the idea of basic emotion theory, that an angry face equals angry emotion, sort of a sad face equals sad emotion, smiling face equals happy emotion. And my work actually shows very different things. It shows that, when Rafael Nadal hits that winning shot, he looks really, really aggressive, raging, you know, yes, I got it. Or even when a kid nails an exam, you can see that, yes. So I feel like those theories do work, and there is some international recognition of what a smile is, what a frowny face is. But when it comes to real life application, it's all over the place. I think we're much messier than those theories would suggest. Otherwise, yeah, it would be hard to understand one another if the aggressive face really did mean anger.
Yeah, really.
It doesn't always.
So doing this research and then presenting it and looking forward to the future, does that change the way that you experience cute aggression personally?
You know, what's funny is I used to do a little bit, and I feel like I do it a lot more now, maybe because I think about it so much. Yeah, you know what's also funny is doing so much research with little cute stimuli, and then now I have two very cute dogs. So I don't know if it was like my natural drive to have cute things around me or if it was the research that pushed me to do it. But yeah, it's changed personally. I think going forward, I think it would be really interesting to understand how these sort of findings impact things like, think about AI research. Think about automatic or automated face reading software that's trying to understand, you know, people's experiences or understand if people, you know, how they're feeling within a crowd. I mean, thinking about how these things play out, what if you are at that soccer game and they're using automatic face reading and people are showing aggression in their faces, not because they're angry, but because they're really excited about a shot getting hit, right? Mm-hmm. So how does this affect our people standing in the community if we have these face readers saying, this person's aggressive, this person's aggressive, this person's aggressive, right? So I think there's some broader implications to the research and how it shapes our lives and policy going forward as well.
You know, I can't let this conversation close without sort of bringing this up just because it's where when I hear cute aggression, it's kind of where my mind goes.
Uh-huh.
But in Mice and Men, I think, is it Larry? Is that, you know, and he's got the mouse in his pocket and he sort of overloves
Lenny.
It. Lenny, that's
yeah.
Right.
Lenny, yeah, I think that's right.
That obviously is not what we're talking about, but that is cute aggression adjacent.
Right. That example actually comes up a lot. A lot of folks bring that up because it's an instance in which, you know, there's sort of this loving that is turned into an ugliness. I think that's the parallel. Mm-hmm. But yeah, really people who show this cute aggression are very, very delicate with their little ones. So it's not at all about actual hurting. It's more about, I think, communicating what's going on inside and how you want to interact with that baby.
Fascinating to know that just within the last decade that this, mm-hmm. you know, you and that it comes from watching Conan, that this is where this started.
It's so interesting.
And has become your life's mission.
What
as you look on the horizon, obviously something you continue to research and study, what are other things that you're hoping to determine?
I'm looking at different expressions now. I've explored that angry type face and the sadness type expressions across different types of scenarios. But I'm also curious in looking at like a disgust face, a face of disgust when you really approve of something, like hearing a great jazz riff and you just have this, like this look of kind of disgust on your face, but it's really good.
Yeah.
And also, you know, how about a bite of a delicious dessert and you make a face as if you're in pain. You're in pain.
And it's you're like, just describing like my day, yeah. Like just how I react in my everyday life, like yeah. To a T.
Well, people who do this do across a variety of expressions. So the person who, you know, cute aggresses at the baby is probably more likely to the person who cries at the wedding as well. Right. So they seem to be within person. So sometimes people do these and they do a good variety of them. And sometimes some people just don't do this at all. And they really do puzzle at those of us who do.
Oftentimes when I have the opportunity to eat with Lisa, she'll bite into whatever she's eating. And the first bite, I'm like, are you okay? Is everything all right? And she's like,
brother. Oh, this is ridiculous. Okay. All right. Shut it down.
It is good, right? You're having an enjoyable experience? All right, good. Enjoy that food. Dr. Yeah. Oriana Aragon, a social psychologist who specializes in studying dimorphous expressions. So great to be able to hear of your work, to hear what you have found and discovered and pioneered, and to see what we'll be looking forward to in the future. If you want to find out more about Dr. Oriana Aragon, you can go to clemson.world/research/Oriana Aragon, and we'd love to have you back on the show in the future as you continue to study these dimorphous expressions. Thanks for being on the show with us.
Coming up in about 6 minutes, we're going to talk about how to unpack lockdown trauma.
Also, we're talking Olympics and we're talking the COVID-19. Yeah, the COVID-19. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
For listening to The Lisa Show. Are you looking for ways to boost your energy throughout the day? Well, in 20 minutes, we're going to share how you can best manage your daily energy. You know, kind of dole it out. But first, it's time for your Morning Buzz with Richie T.
That's right. It's three things that are trending online right now, things that folks are talking about. There is chit and or chatter about these things. The first one, the Walt Disney Company, they said, hey, 2,000 employees from Southern California. How do you like Florida?
Really?
Would that be a thing that you would like to do? So these are a lot of their sort of office and or other type employees. These aren't obviously theme park employees or anything like that. They've said it's been in the works for a long time. This isn't just because of...
Oh, okay. You know,
this isn't just political things between California and Florida. Wink. So they are planning to move. They don't know who the 2,000 employees are at this point.
And to be clear, we're not talking about Mickey and Minnie.
Yeah. Come on. Don't get crazy. Jiminy Cricket, you're fine.
Okay.
Stress not, Jiminy. But give a little whistle. You can see the campus. They have a draw up of what the campus is going to look like. Looks super cool. Disney always takes care of their employees. But yeah, 2,000 people in the nearest future will be informed. Hey, so... we value you. What do you think about Florida instead of Southern California? Also, this record-breaking floods have killed at least 150 people in Western Europe, and the video is trending online right now of just the damage and destruction that's happening. That has happened. Most of the deaths are in Germany's west, where the disaster area stretches between the towns of Heinsberg, Erfstadt, and Ahrweiler. Near the border with Netherlands and Belgium, more than 130 people have been confirmed dead. There's more than 1,000 still missing. President Frank-Walter Steinmeier has promised support for victim families into the damaged towns. In Belgium, at least 20 people have died in the flooding, and the government has declared Tuesday, that is tomorrow, a national day of mourning. And then finally this, U.S. tennis star Coco Gauff, which not only is a phenomenal tennis player, but excellently named... no longer going to lead the U.S. tennis team at the Tokyo Olympics. She announced that she tested positive for the coronavirus, dashing her hopes of competing in the Games. Quote, it's always been a dream of mine to represent the USA at the Olympics, and I hope there will be many more chances for me to make this come true in the future, the 17-year-old said in a statement on her Twitter account. Gauff was tapped to lead the 12-member group earlier this month in what would have been her first Olympics team. This is the first time in nearly quarter a century that there won't be a Serena or Venus Williams on the team. So it was definitely a change in the guard, and now we're changing it again because Coco Gauff has tested positive for coronavirus. That, my friends, is your Morning Buzz.
Thanks, Richie T.
49 of the 50 states have now officially lifted all COVID-19 restrictions. After a year and a half of social distancing, mandated mask wearing, and remote working, we can finally say that life is returning back to normal. But wait. NBC News reports the rapidly spreading Delta variant is threatening plans to lift COVID-19 restrictions across the world. So... does that mean that we might have to endure another lockdown? And if so, what does that mean for those who are still working through the trauma of their first lockdown experience? Well, here with us today is author and clinical psychologist certified in trauma therapy, Dr. Catherine Athens. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you. It's my pleasure
for
to
many,
be with you. Thank you.
For many, lockdown was either a paradise or torture. What do you think made the difference between a good lockdown experience and a bad one?
Well, just if someone is an introvert or an extrovert, if someone has good home life, people are harmonious at home, if they have enough equipment, comfortable chair, decent food, I think a lot of factors came to make up a good lockdown. However, I don't know anyone, I'm just saying anyone, who wants to go back to a lockdown.
Right, right. And even further, to take a step further in what you were saying, I don't know anyone who had all of those things or took everything in stride without any sort of bumps. It maybe overall was a great experience, but getting there was rough. Or at first it was jarring, and then they were able to get into good pace. And I think that's where we hear the phrase more and more now, on this side of the pandemic, of this idea of lockdown trauma. What is that?
Oh, that's a real thing. It's like post-traumatic stress disorder. Lockdown trauma brought out all kinds of issues from childhood, authoritarian issues, feelings of being inadequate, insecure, unworthy, unable. All kinds of feelings where people who did well, quote-unquote well, with a lockdown. I was with a client. She said, I don't want to go out and see people anymore.
Right.
Here's a person who loved going out to see people. I really don't like it. I'm getting nervous. I'm becoming anxious. What can I do? I said, well, try to take the baby steps and see people a little bit at a time and realize what's going on inside of you. But there's a real anxiety that goes on with this lockdown trauma. And even more, a lot of people suffered and unconsciously interpreted it as punishment. And this is a big problem for people who are a little unstable to begin with. So consequently, we've seen more violence, more gun violence. We've seen more divorce. The divorce rate went up, I don't know, 35-40%. We've seen more violence toward kids. It went up about 35-40%. And unexplained, but there are many, many people who have not worked through their childhood trauma. And this lockdown brought that all out at once.
So how do we then begin to do that process? Because maybe we weren't aware of childhood drama or trauma, and we certainly weren't ready to deal with it. The pandemic sort of brought us forefront with it. How do we take those first steps to be able to deal with that trauma?
Well, I think first of all, admitting, hey, I'm traumatized. There are things in my life that I get nervous about that I never used to be nervous about, or things in my life I just don't want to do that I don't want to go to the dry cleaners. I want him to pick up the clothes outside. I don't even want to talk to him. So first, admit there's a problem. Secondly, go to your local local hospital, social services, even your place of worship, and see if there are people who can talk to you. Try to talk to somebody who has some credentials in counseling and just start a conversation, and don't feel ashamed or afraid, because everyone has suffered some degree of this anxiety, some degree of feeling trapped. So whoever you are, you're not alone. Of course, if there are a lack of mental health workers now, because there are so many mental health problems that have gone on, and we've seen that. However, if you do go to your local hospital, your social services, and say, hey, where can I go? There are a lot of community health centers that have counselors that can talk to you.
You mentioned and made great point to say, make sure that they're credentialed in some way. Is there value even in just sharing that you feel you know, somewhat traumatized or have had, even just if you couch it as just a difficult time with a friend or someone who isn't credentialed.
Well, absolutely, because your friend is going to tell you, I feel the same way. So don't feel alone. Part of the trauma is feeling isolated and alone and that other people aren't having the same experience when other people are having the very same experience. So, yes, of course, there's value. But a lot of these traumas have sprung from some deeper problem that's been covered up, and now it's uncovered, and people don't know how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. We're visiting with Dr. Catherine Athens about working through lockdown trauma, and I appreciate that sort of as your first piece of advice, you say make sure that you're visiting with someone who can sort of talk you through this and that individual has credentials and can be able to help you unpack some of that. How, as we're starting to find our way through it, are there ways to sort of check the gauge and see how we're doing, if we're recovering, if things are going worse? What kind of questions or things should we be looking for within ourselves or within our loved ones to know if we're handling this properly?
I think that's a great question. And first of all, how are you feeling inside? Mm-hmm. And before this, we, of course, are not an inside country. We're an outside country. You know, we have to acquire things, and we are working on our devices, and now we're saying, wait a moment, go and see what your inside life is about. I've told people maybe start reading some old philosophers, you know, old Socrates, who told us to know ourselves. Try to go backwards in that sense so you can go forward in your life. If you're shaking when you walk out the door, it's a sure sign there's something going on inside. If your friend is having trouble using words, sure sign something's going on. A lot of people have called me and said, I'm having these terrible nightmares. I don't know what to do. So I say, keep a journal, call me, we'll talk them through. Those are sure signs I'm not sleeping well. And I tell people, you know, go get some aerobic exercise in the morning because that will start your day, that will energize yourselves and start you off for a day where at night then you can relax. So many of us are tense all day, mm-hmm. and we go from being tense at the desk or tense at the TV or the device to tense in bed, and suddenly we're going, now we have to sleep. Sleep is like getting up in the morning. You have to take time and have rituals, go to sleep the same time every night. Mm-hmm. I recommend people go to bed early. I'm an early bird because you get better sleep before midnight. Maybe a hot bath or a warm bath, maybe a yoga practice, doing some stretching before you go to sleep, doing some breathing, having an affirmation so that you can think of something positive as you go about your business, since there's so many negative things. If you are a watcher of TV, I know I have several clients who are addicted to every news program. I have to watch everything. Mm-hmm. And I say, turn off the TV for a day. Put your device away for a day. Go outside. Sit under a tree. Go to the park. Just sit and look that everything is okay. I think people need to know that everything is okay. The world is still turning. The trees are still growing. The grass is still growing. Mm-hmm. That everything is okay, and they will be okay as well. This is a temporary state that people are in. It isn't the permanent state.
I want to walk through something that you said. You mentioned the news, right? And if we've been watching the news recently, we certainly have heard a considerable amount of the Delta variant. And I don't want to get into what news tries to do or tries not to do. But I would be curious to know, if we find ourselves in another lockdown situation, what can we take from our initial lockdown situation to be able to help maybe navigate that a little bit better? Or would we just find ourselves impacted to to an nth degree because we didn't deal with it from the first time and now we find ourselves in it again?
Well, all of those things are possible. What some people did is they discovered reading again. Some people discovered painting again or doing needlework or knitting again. Some people discovered that they could play with their kids, that they could use their imaginations and play silly games, maybe out in the backyard. So there were a lot of wonderful things that people discovered during the last lockdown that perhaps they didn't know about themselves or forgot, you know, as well as feeling really pressured and feeling punished. Understand if you were feeling that way, then it's important to get some help because a second lockdown will be exponentially worse in those feelings. It's like you take a horse's leg, you know, and you put electrical impulse in it. Well, at first it kicks, and then afterwards it doesn't do anything. It's frozen. And I admonish people not to get to the point of being frozen. You know, if you have a favorite group that you go to, I was talking to my banker the other day. He said, my men's group has given me a lot of support. We've met through Zoom during the lockdown. We're meeting more in person now. Get yourself with a group of people. It's really important. As humans, we were able to survive because of the group. And the group gives us social interaction, but more, it keeps us balanced and present and normal. The brain needs human interaction to be okay, and that's part of what happened in this lockdown. There wasn't a lot of human interaction. And so then the brain began to shrink in ways, and the nervous system began to act in a strange way. So please, I admonish everybody to get human interaction and go to your local community center, senior center. Every city has some community classes, even if they're on Zoom, to just get to be talking to somebody if indeed we need to go back and lock down again.
Really great advice. And I just to reemphasize something that you said, that we need that connection, that connectivity to other humans. It's not a great suggestion or wouldn't it be nice if, but that it's a need that we need to be able to have, that maybe we didn't take a great care of during the lockdown previously, but that we need other people, that we need that connection, that we need to be looking for those that might be struggling and make that connection to take the time with them and be able to help people through a very traumatic experience. Even those folks, you know, I found myself in the early kind of opening up. I don't feel like I deal with a lot of trauma, but that first experience being out and about after the lockdown, it was almost crippling to the point that I couldn't wrap my head around what was going and the anxiousness that I felt within that particular situation. And so being able to talk with someone about it and being able to be honest about where we're at and where we're not at and connect with others. I really appreciate everything that you have shared with us. Dr. Catherine Athens is an author and a licensed marriage and family therapist who's been practicing for over 25 years. If you want to find out more about her and her work, you can hop online to CatherineAthensPhD.com.
And just a quick reminder that Lisa's Adventure Club is still well underway. Just go to BYUradio.org to enter for a chance to win an annual National Parks Pass. We're giving away one pass every week this summer long.
BYUradio.org. Coming up, we're going to share some techniques to help you manage your energy every day.
Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. Every day we have plenty of tasks to complete, many hats to wear, and sometimes it may seem overwhelming that it's hard to know where to begin. So the question I think that races through all of our minds is, how can we manage our daily energy and navigate the highs and the lows that our day-to-day lives bring? Well, to join our conversation as part of Mental Wellness Monday is John Sovic, a California-based therapist and friend of The Lisa Show. John is here to shed some light and give us some techniques on how we can best manage our daily energy. Welcome, John.
Thank you. It's so great to chat with you about this. This is a subject that I'm so passionate about. And I don't think people really think about, like, how to use the amount of energy that they wake up with effectively during their day.
I think that you're right. And that's why I'm really excited that you're so passionate about this topic, because I don't think that most of us stop to differentiate between managing our energy and managing our time. So let's just start there. What are the differences, or how do you frame it?
So for me, when I look at time management, it is about task completion. It's about finding ways to get a job done within a schedule, within a framework. When I'm talking about paying attention to your energy, mm-hmm. it's about learning your own personal rhythms. When and during the day do you have the most energy to do certain types of tasks? So an example, for myself, I actually tend to be a morning person. Mm-hmm. I wake up early, I take the dog for a walk, do a little yoga, do a meditation, and then I get into the business of my day, the responses of my mm-hmm. day. I do my email, I do my writing. It's the place where I'm in a sweet spot for that. But if you ask me to write an article at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, my brain would refuse to put words on paper. Okay.
Yeah. I'm only laughing because it sounds so familiar.
But it is about understanding those rhythms of the day. Because at the same time, you may be a person that when you wake up in the morning, your brain is not ready to start the function mill. So you need to start a little bit slower. You need to not take on big projects in the morning. And all of us have these rhythms that go through our day. We just need to learn how to pay attention to them. Because if we park the perfect piece of project or work or connectivity into the piece of energy during the day where it will most succeed, just think of all the things that you could accomplish.
Well, for sure. And, you know, we're always talking about productivity, right? And not procrastinating and using the best use of our time. So how can we identify, you know, if this is a foreign concept to us, sort of our energy rhythms, and tell if our energy is maybe lower than it should be just as a baseline?
Mm-hmm. So what I do with clients is I encourage them to just keep a little like a mood track during the day. I say, let's have you write down at 10 and 8 at 9 a.m., at noon, at 3, at 6, and at 10 at night. Like on a scale of 1 to 10, where's your energy at that time? Okay?
Yeah.
And then we look at that and we start to notice there's a trend. You know, every day at 3 o'clock, I actually have a lot of energy. 3 o'clock might be after a lunch, okay? Or I find at 10 p.m. at night, I'm suddenly really focused and mm-hmm. I have a lot of energy. We pay attention to this. And that's how we start finding the track. Really simple. Check in multiple times during the day, this 1 to 10, with 10 being I'm totally energized and 1 be like I'm going to lay down on the sofa and take a nap.
Right.
And once you do that for like a week, you will start to notice the patterns. And these patterns are how we can then make the change happen.
So how do you adjust your identification of all of these highs and lows in your energy levels to what needs to get done during the day? Because we have to respond to the demands from a boss or from our work or our children. So how do you adapt?
Mm-hmm. So once again, it is about paying attention. So if after school I'm picking up my kids, okay, and they like are like, ah, we got to do all this stuff, we got all this stuff, but I'm in my low energy place, mm-hmm. then I need to know I need to find things for them to do that are going to keep them busy and distracted. Okay, to focus them on their guitar lesson, their sports, their homework, their own self-care, because I'm not in a place where I can do that. Mm-hmm. But then I know at 5 o'clock every day, I get a big energy boost. And at five, it's like, okay, kids, come together. Let's make dinner together. Hey, let's go outside and take a walk before we make dinner. Mm. If I know this about myself, I'm not going to get at the car, kids pile in the car at 3 o'clock. And I'm just like, okay, kids, let's try to do something.
All right, let me rally.
I am not going to be there. Yeah, and the rallying thing is actually one of those false ideas of how we pay attention to energy, because oftentimes those rallies are based on either us trying to fake it, or they're based on us using something like caffeine or sugar to try and come up for that rally, okay? And it's really funny because I'll just reflect a thing from my life that I know really strongly about myself.
Okay.
And it comes to like managing food. So first of all, I actually don't do caffeine in my life. It's something I stopped a long time ago, and that helps me to pay better attention to my rhythms. But I also know this really weird thing about myself. And if on the weekends we go out to breakfast and I have pancakes, everybody knows in the family that I'm going to be sleeping the rest of the day.
Right.
Okay? Because pancakes, heavy carbs, make me get sleepy. And so it's just kind of like, oh, so you're going to rest today? It's like, yes, I am.
Oh, so today is a resting day. Yeah.
Yeah. But understanding that relationship to caffeine, to food, are also ways to understand how we're trying to fake our energy. There's a really beautiful principle that we use in yoga, and it's to do a task, do a pose within the energy that you are bringing to your mat that day. So what does that mean? If I show up and I'm really tired that morning and I try and do something really complex, I'm going to get muddy, I'm going to feel overwhelmed, and I'm not going to be able to accomplish that thing. But if I say, I'm a little bit tired this morning, I'm going to take it easy as I come into this task, guess what? You're actually going to be more effective at doing it. So rather than trying to do that rally energy, you're respecting the idea that I'm at a low of my energy right now, but I'm going to respect that lowness, and now I'm going to go with that line of energy, and you're actually going to get something done. The same thing when you're feeling all like buzzy and electric, and you're like, okay, I'm going to manage that all down, squish it all down, and do a very, very, like, you know, sit still task. Ain't going to happen. But if you recognize I'm big, high, buzzy, and electric, and you say, like, okay, this is the time to, like, move the stuff around the house. This is the time to clean. This is the time to exercise.
I'm in the zone.
If you if you pay attention to those zones, that's where you can actually work much more effectively and efficiently.
John Sovic, friend of The Lisa Show, is here talking to us about managing our daily energy and really rethinking the way that we are managing our time, I think, you know, playing to our strengths and planning that successful day. And I appreciate you laying the foundation for it, because it really is a paradigm shift for a lot of us who just maybe organize our day by the tasks we need to complete and maybe don't give as much consideration for setting ourselves up for success. And it might be something that some of us notice anecdotally, but really, like, focusing on this kind of shift and playing to our strengths could be a big game changer. It seems like we'd be more productive. What kind of changes have you seen when people sort of switch from, well, I've always done it this way, to, no, this is when I'm the most productive. I'm going to change the way that I do it. What have you seen?
Well, I think the always doing it that way thing is the biggest trap for all of us, you know?
It is. It's hard.
But what I've noticed with clients is, like, some of my corporate clients, it's the idea of, like, knowing that I schedule meetings between 2 and 4 o'clock, and they come out of these meetings feeling productive, and we created these new ideas and programs because my brain is really clicking. It's working with, you know, people who say, you know, from 8:30 to 10 in the morning, it's all about sitting still and answering emails because my physical energy is not high, but I can focus on those things. And the other task that I give a lot of people to really manage and look at this energy quotient is also to understand that you go to work, you sit down, and you're at that desk for 8 to 10 hours a day. Our bodies were not made to do that.
Yeah.
So what I encourage people to do, there is a certain type of rhythm that we go through with our mental energy, and it's usually about a 90-minute to 2-hour cycle at most. Is that I have people use timers and get up every 90 minutes, 2 hours, depending on how their day works, and take a walk around the office, take a walk around the block. I have a lot of my clients that I really encourage at lunchtime is put a walk in and a light lunch versus sitting down and just sitting in another chair and having lunch. And these things can have a huge effect on our personal sense of well-being. And the thing that's really fascinating, especially for people who are very high achievers, is if we can work with these energy highs and lows, what they find is at the end of the day, when they come home to their family, their partners, or the other things they want to do with their life, that they actually are much more available to do those things because their body, their mind, their spirit, their emotional wellness feels much more taken care of during the day.
Well, what a great point to bring up, because we're having so many conversations in the workplace and in families about burnout, right? About, you know, why are we, you know, just all feeling so sort of overwhelmed? And this is actually something of like to consider, right? Incorporating into your daily habits to give you that kind of emotional and physical energy. I'm wondering if there's something that we haven't talked about that could maximize our productivity or help us have a little bit more energy as we're thinking about playing to our strengths.
Well, I would also like to include the idea of giving yourself transition time between tasks. So if you are sitting down and writing the next great American novel, and you're doing that for 2 hours, and then your next task is to go to a meeting and do a presentation, you need to take about 10 minutes in between those tasks to give yourself a little bit of time to reset, because you're moving into a different use of your energy. The solo idea of being at the computer and writing has a very certain energy to it. Standing in front of a room and presenting a PowerPoint has a different energy. But if you just try and slug from one to the other, it's going to not work as well for you. But if you say, okay, writing's done, I've got to do that presentation, I have 10 minutes, I'm going to take a walk, I'm going to take a breath, I'm going to get some water, I'm going to listen to some music. I have a client that we have built in this really specific thing. They are using one of the online meditation apps, and we're having them do these 10-minute guided meditations between big chunks of their day. And it has absolutely changed their ability to focus in each of those different tasks that they're required to do during their day.
Oh, wow. Such a great tip and so much good information to really like rethink the way that we do things. I'm wondering if, you know, we're doing these kinds of things and we kind of know, oh, yeah, I'm just thinking personally, I need to get, because I wake up so early, I feel like my most productive of, you know, hours are from 5 a.m. to noon, right? Like I can get so much done and be able to maximize during that, because that's when I just feel awake and alive. So from, but if I try to do the same task after noon, or if heaven forbid it's like at 3 p.m. or 4 p.m., then it might take me two or three times longer, right? And so once we figure out that kind of trend in ourselves or in others, are there other ways that you have to sort of increase energy maybe on our off times that don't involve, you know, high amounts of caffeine and sugar?
So, you know, it's interesting. If I think specifically to your schedule, this is a little trick that I use, and I think it's amazing. I am such a big believer in the power of naps.
Okay.
So you wake up at 5 a.m., you do a lot of stuff, and then by noon, your body has basically kind of had a full day.
Yeah.
So it could be incredibly powerful to give yourself about a 20-minute nap, and then when you come out of it, set up for the next part of your day and whatever things you want to do there. I learned long ago to manage this whole like 20-minute nap thing. I have this really weird technique that I can do where I can just go to sleep and I will automatically wake up in 20 minutes.
You will?
People are freaked out by it. I'm just being honest with you.
Yeah, I still haven't managed that. I mean, I wake up in the 4 o'clock hour so I can just like hit the ground running at five. But
right.
I always set the timer and I know a lot of people do this and you think, oh, five more minutes, right? So what do you do?
Okay. So the 5 more minute thing, this could be a whole nother episode about sleep.
It is. And we'll have to have you come back. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But the napping thing, here's what we understand about what napping can do for the body. And the reason why I use the 20-minute model is because what we've looked at is the way the brain functions is the 20-minute model of napping takes us just to a point where we're releasing, relaxing, quieting the mind down, but it doesn't take us into that deep REM sleep cycle. Because that's what happens if we go into that REM sleep cycle, that we wake up all groggy and we can't do anything. But finding our personal energies, a 10-15 minute nap, set the timer on your phone, that can help you reset and give yourself a little break in the day. And then when you come out of it, you're like, okay, cool. What do I want to do next? And so I am a big believer in the power of napping as a way to reset and manage some of our energy during the day.
Lots of great ways to boost your energy, have a little bit more daily energy, and certainly manage it. Thank you so much, John, for being here.
Thank you.
John Sovic's a therapist based in Pasadena, a friend of the Lisa Show. You can learn more about him by jumping over to Instagram at John Sovic Therapy. The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio. You can find everything you need on the BYU Radio app, where you can listen on demand. You can also find us on SiriusXM channel 143.
If you like us, find the podcast, The Lisa Show. Be sure to subscribe.
On tomorrow's show, we're going to learn about the life of a chess prodigy.
Thank you for making The Lisa Show a part of your day.